All right, everyone. If we can get back to business, on va retourner au travail. Welcome back, everyone. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Professor Alan Downie, and he'll be talking about lacrosse. So we will, I think, get into this whole is what is the national sport of Canada. Alan is a member of the Nacostly First Nation and an academic associate in Indigenous Studies at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. He's a graduate of Wilfrid Laurier University, joined McGill last fall after teaching in both the Department of History and North American Studies program at Laurier. He's been playing lacrosse since he was 10 years old. He's played at several of the highest levels, including being drafted professionally. And he's taken that passion for the sport and turned it into a PhD project and now a forthcoming book. The book is titled The Creator's Game, focuses on the history of lacrosse in Indigenous communities from 1867 to 1990 to better understand Native newcomer relations and Indigenous identity formation. Apart from teaching, Alan splits his time volunteering for Indigenous communities and youth organizations. And so he's here today to present Identity Games, Indigenous Identities, and the Game of Lacrosse on the West Coast. So please give a good welcome to Professor Alan Downie.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction. Before I begin, I'd just like to acknowledge the Ganyangahaga territory that we're on. As Indigenous peoples, we always know that we work, travel, or live on someone's Indigenous territory, if not our own, and so we recognize that. So over the course of the next 20 minutes, what I intend to do is weave a story for you. How the game of lacrosse has historically been a critical piece of Indigenous identities in the Vancouver area. The game of lacrosse has a long and rich history on the West Coast, and this is especially true for the Indigenous people of the Squamish Nation in North Vancouver. By the time the modern game of lacrosse traveled west from Ontario and Quebec in the 1880s, the original Squamish game of Tekwala, this is a hybrid form of lacrosse and rugby, actually disappeared, although it lived on in the memory and oral traditions of the Squamish people. See, since the formation of BC's first lacrosse league in 1890, the newly transported game came from the east, and it was dominated by non-natives in the region. Unlike the situation in eastern Canada, where Indigenous athletes were barred from official competition after 1880, the Squamish were actively competing against non-native teams on the west coast beginning in the early 1920s. Introduced to the game in residential schools, the Squamish quickly embraced lacrosse, not in the pursuit of Canadian citizenship, as was the intention by the dominant society, but as citizens of the Squamish Nation. From the beginning, the Squamish quickly realized lacrosse as an instrument for community integration, and both locally and nationally throughout the 20th century. See, what a case study of lacrosse allows us to see is the intersection of multiple identities, both local nationalism, i.e. the Squamish Nation, and more broadly in terms of a pan-Indigenous identity, i.e. what it meant to be Indigenous, or using the historical connotation, what it meant to be Indian. They were defining it. Well, where to start? Where do we begin this story? Well, why not here in Montreal? A gift from the Creator. That's where it all began. In the Haudenosaunee worldview, also known as the Iroquois, the game of lacrosse is believed to be a gift from the Creator, and it's been a central element of North American Indigenous cultures and traditional worldviews for centuries. It was one of the most widely practiced games before contact, right here in Ganyangahaga territory. However, the sport of lacrosse has undergone a considerable amount of change since the introduction of non-Indigenous players in the 1840s. The introduction of non-Indigenous players and athletes in Montreal in 1844, that's the year the first recorded lacrosse game took place between Indigenous and non-Indigenous athletes, it significantly altered the Indigenous game of lacrosse. From that point on, the game was appropriated from Indigenous peoples and molded into a sport stripped of its original cultural and ceremonial significance, which exemplified instead Victorian Anglo values. By 1867, it was unofficially declared Canada's national sport, and it became the most popular game in and around major urban centers right up to the First World War. There was no sport that was bigger than lacrosse up until that point, not even hockey or basketball or baseball. Through this reformulation, non-natives attempted to establish a Canadian identity through the sport and actually barred Indigenous athletes from championship competitions in 1880. They actually banned Indigenous peoples from their own game. And yet, lacrosse's native originators still played the game and continued to hold it as a significant piece of their identity. While Haudenosaunee teams from Ganawage, just across the river, Akwesasne, outside of Cornwall, and Six Nations, just outside of Brantford, Ontario, continued to travel throughout North America and Europe playing exhibition matches, they didn't participate in official Canadian national championships for over a century. It'd actually take 110 years to kind of right this historical injustice. You see, throughout Canadian history, sport has been a powerful agent of colonialism in the attempt to assimilate Indigenous peoples. During the late 19th and early 20th century, sports and recreation played a significant role in residential schools across Canada, as administrators felt that athletics would help in their so-called civilizing process. This is particularly true concerning the game of lacrosse. Here, an Indigenous game, an important Indigenous cultural and spiritual element, was taken by non-Indigenous people and embraced as a marker of a national identity. The perception of the game as a reflection of a distinct Canadian identity, it became so pervasive, so powerful, that Canadians began using it as an assimilative device in residential schools as an example of whiteness. As early as 1879, the Department of Indian Affairs began to systematically fund and implement residential schools as a government policy in the pursuit of civilizing Indigenous peoples and assimilating them into Canadian society. Between 1879 and 1923, the school system grew without planning, and there really was no master plan. Well, similarly, the implementation of sport in residential schools also shared an inauspicious start. Throughout the 1880s and 1890s, the implementation of sport grew steadily in residential schools across Canada, but what was offered depended on the local school administration. Regardless, it remains that sport became a significant feature of the residential school system. To school administrators, sports such as cricket, soccer, and boxing were all seen as idealistic introductions to Western, that is British or Canadian, culture, and whiteness for Indigenous youth, and really another opportunity for moral training. As the inspector of the Protestant Industrial School remarked in 1888 concerning the Battlefield Industrial School in Saskatchewan, he says, quote, "A noticeable feature of this school is its games. They are all thoroughly and distinctly white. The boys use boxing gloves with notable science and excellent temper, and play good games of cricket and football with great interest and truly Anglo-Saxon vigor. The girls dress, make fancy articles of dress, and play such games as white children do. From all their recreations, Indianism is excluded." Well, shortly hereafter, the inspector would implement lacrosse into the school program as a further example of whiteness. From Ontario to British Columbia, with the exception of Alberta, school administrators began introducing lacrosse into residential schools beginning in 1889. But the introduction of lacrosse in residential schools is actually what I like to call a raven tale. See, raven in Indigenous storytelling is a trickster, a character in the stories that serves as an analogy, where they often create things in the world accidentally by not following cultural protocols. Often, Raven gets into trouble or looks like a fool and accidentally creates something in the world to the benefit of Indigenous peoples while looking like a fool or accidentally messing the balance up. Not only does this teach us about how things are created, but also about social lessons in the oral history. Well, lacrosse in residential schools is a Raven tale. It was a trick. It was introduced to mean one thing and accomplish the goal of assimilation, but it actually had the opposite effect. See, Indigenous peoples weren't sitting idly by watching their societies be eroded or eradicated by the dominant society. Rather, they developed new ways to incorporate their old traditions into new forms and unify their identity and political voice. One group that was extremely successful at this was the Squamish Nation on the North Shore of Vancouver. The Squamish used the game of lacrosse to unify and strengthen their community. Ultimately, they created a racialized identity through the sport, consisting of a Squamish nationalism and a pan-Indigenous identity. While faced with the growing settlements in and around Squamish territory and the civilizing efforts pertaining to Canada's assault on Indigenous communities, i.e. residential schools, the Indian Act, the reserve system, in the second half of the 19th century, British Columbia's lower mainland, including Squamish territory, transformed from an Indigenous-controlled space to an area controlled by non-Native governments, laws, businesses, and leadership. Well, in turn, the identity of the Squamish was challenged, and they had to redefine the collective identity they held both as Squamish and part of the larger collective, Coast Salish people of Lower Mainland, Vancouver Island, and Washington State. Well, within these spaces of colonial control, especially the reserve system, Indigenous communities carved out for themselves passive resistance, control, however limited, and new forms of identity. The Squamish adapted and absorbed elements of non-Indigenous culture, lacrosse being an example, within their own as they had historically done since contact. On the West Coast, the growth of the game was due in large part to British Columbia's entrance into Confederation in 1871. As new residents arrived from the East, they brought their lacrosse sticks with them and actually transplanted the game to the new province and to Indigenous communities. Although the game grew quickly and drew a large following in the cities of Vancouver, Victoria, and New Westminster by 1900, the Squamish remained on the fringes of the sport due to a rule in the BC Lacrosse Association that banned all Indians when it was formed in 1890, following a similar ban that was here in Eastern Canada or Central Canada. However, the Squamish absence from lacrosse changed dramatically with the forced introduction of the game in 1905. See, in 1905, the Squamish residential school, seen here on the left, they introduced the game. Well, as they introduced this game, there's a young pupil there named Andy Paul. Andy would go on later to become a well-known Indigenous rights activist. Well, temporarily, sport and recreation offered students a break from the monotonous regime of residential school life. On a more long-term basis, lacrosse offered Indigenous communities a mechanism to maintain and develop their culture, independence, and identity. Following his tenure at the residential school, Paul developed a working knowledge and voice pertaining to Squamish affairs, political affairs, and land claims at really a young age. Simultaneously, as Paul was discovering his voice as a political representative of the Squamish Nation, he, along with a number of other Squamish leaders, were helping to establish a new cultural element and create a racialized identity through sport. For Paul and the other early organizers, Squamish lacrosse teams presented an opportunity not only to rebuild community pride and identity, but to maintain their culture. One venue that allowed such an opportunity presented itself at the Indian Sports Days exhibitions held each year beginning in 1916 by a non-Indigenous promoter named Con Jones. These Indian Sports Days were held basically during holiday events, so during Dominion Day or during Victoria Day. And really what they were was they were an exhibition of Indigenous athletes and performers for non-Indigenous audiences. See, the fascination and demand by non-natives, as well as potential gate receipts for promoters, often push Indigenous culture from the underground and brought it before a curious and paying public. This is the whole idea of the vanishing Indian myth. Non-Indigenous peoples thought that because of their supposed racial inferiority, that Indigenous peoples were going to disappear. So we need to go out and see them as quickly as possible before they disappear. This is why these Indian sports days are popping up across the country. People really do think that they're disappearing and that they're going to die out. We need to see their culture before they do. Well, as part of this, we have the 1916 Victoria Day celebrations and then the inaugural Indian Sports Day. Promoter Con Jones announced actually an exhibition of Indigenous dancing to accompany a lacrosse tournament. There's a problem with this. Because there was an 1884 amendment to the Indian Act, that is Canadian law, which restricted Jones' attempt as it outlawed the culture of Indigenous peoples on the West Coast and the spiritual ceremonies such as the potlatch and dancing. The potlatch is the traditional governing structure in a ceremony. It was further amended in 1914 to make off-reserve dancing punishable by incarceration, and it required Indigenous peoples to receive permission to appear in the regalia, or their traditional dress. Well, after making the initial announcement that the celebration would feature Indian dancing in Aboriginal costume, Jones was quickly made aware of the legal restrictions that limited such an event. In response, assumingly fearful of disappointing the non-Indigenous audience, Jones successfully appealed to the Department of Indian Affairs in Ottawa to allow the event to take place. So the tightening vice of the Department of Indian Affairs control and enforcement continued to attempt to limit the cultural sovereignty of Indigenous nations, and with it, their identity. However, these Indian sports days offered an outlet for Indigenous participants to circumvent the department's regulations and enabled them to gather with other distant First Nations and practice their culture. They weren't simply an apolitical leisure activity that was taking place. As the Squamish elder Pechmuk captured, he said, quote, if you could not have a potlatch, if you could not have a feast, there was always that gathering, sport, that they could pass on the traditions, the ceremonies. Because you couldn't be jailed for gathering at a sport event, but you could be jailed for gathering at a potlatch. So they found a way to have it, to continue it, and to have it by having these sports events. While the Department of Indian Affairs and Indian agents, who were overseeing the ban on Indigenous culture, viewed the participation of Squamish athletes as a sign of their successful progression towards assimilation, the Squamish used the sports days to continue their language, culture, and ceremonies right under the surveillance of the officials. The officials didn't recognize that they were just continuing their culture and their ceremonies at these sports events, and so that's why they continued to push them. But let's skip ahead a little bit and talk about a little bit what's going on in the 1930s, because by 1930, some of the greatest players to ever come out of the Squamish Nation were competing for the National Senior Championship of Canada, the highest level of lacrosse, as Paul, skilled lawyer and Indigenous rights activist, was able to actually reverse the ban on Indigenous athletes in the West. It continued here, though. Further encouraging the return of Indigenous athletes was actually the creation of box lacrosse, that is, indoor lacrosse. And one of the founders of this form of the game was actually the Montreal Canadiens owner between 1931 and 1932. What was happening was the NHL owners had these new arenas that they couldn't fill in the summertime. There were empty spaces. You had the circus come in once in a while, and you could have these, you know, one-off kind of events, but they needed something to put people in the seats. So what they thought was, let's take lacrosse, an outdoor game, reduce the numbers, and create rules that look a lot like hockey, draw our hockey audiences inside to fill these empty hockey arenas in the summertime. Well, throughout the early 1930s, lacrosse audiences varied greatly in a number, from a few dozen to a few thousand on any given night. However, as the decade rolled on, the game of lacrosse witnessed a rejuvenation in which Andy Paul's new team, the Squamish Indians, were a central part. By 1934, games that had once only witnessed a hundred or so spectators were now actually pushing the limits of local arenas. Filling one of Western North America's greatest sporting facilities, the Denman Arena, which was downtown Vancouver, Andy Paul's Squamish Indians lacrosse team became a landmark of Vancouver and its sporting culture. They became really Vancouver's team, the original kind of big sports team. But a unique development occurred as the Squamish re-entered the highest level of lacrosse competition for the 1935 season. They carried with them a new name and a new contingent of players. It was in that year that Andy Paul began recruiting Haudenosaunee athletes to play out west and rename the team the North Shore Indians, dropping Squamish from the name. No longer would the all-native team carry out the Squamish identity alone. Rather, they helped solidify pan-Indigenous identity and relationship for those who participated, their fans, the Squamish and Haudenosaunee, and all Indigenous peoples that followed the team. We can see across the country in newspaper reports that Indigenous people were showing up to these lacrosse games, wherever they might be as they're traveling across the country, to support this team because they see them as the Indian team or the Indigenous team. Paul wanted, really, an all-Native contender for the Canadian Championship and actually sold the club's players on the idea of returning to his team as a matter of Indigenous pride and responsibility. As he and other players would often say in the press, lacrosse was our game, in which they associated it as being an Indigenous game and being representative of Indigenous peoples. Let's not have it lost on us that this was introduced to them in residential schools to get rid of that identity as an Indigenous person. The organization united the Squamish unlike any other team in their history, and embedded themselves as one of the most important cultural developments in the 20th century, as hundreds of fans from the Squamish communities would travel to Vancouver to watch their team. Andy Paul's friend and biographer, Father Herbert Dunlop, captured it best when he said, quote, "Those who could find a few pennies headed for the arena and the forums and found relief in sharing vicarious victories of their favorite team. And when they lost, a responsive chord was sounded in the depths of their souls. Down on Denman Street in the old forum, they forgot for a few hours the corner around which prosperity lurked was far beyond their reach. They forgot how poor the poor were and how maddeningly rich the rich were. They forgot these things because before them were the darlings of the lacrosse world, the Squamish Indians. Smaller in stature than the white teams they played, how easy it was to identify with them as they moved with lightning speed and down teams twice their size. They were always the underdogs, but underdogs that clawed their way to the top time and time again, and many a man tasted a momentary sip of sweet triumph." Continuing to play at the Denman Arena in Vancouver, Paul once again acquired a number of other Haudenosaunee players from Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve, just outside of Brantford, Ontario again, to join the team in 1936. Not only were the Squamish establishing an identity for themselves, they were also helping to create a pan-Indigenous identity through lacrosse and developing a relationship with Eastern communities that would blossom and extend beyond the sport. Together, the all-native team made it to the national championship in 1936 at Maple Leaf Gardens, where over the series of four games, 31,000 people ended up showing up. And who was doing the play-by-play? Foster Hewitt. So how do we know that this identity extended beyond sport? And what I'm telling you is actually truthful. Well, here's an example. Well, in the 1940s, Andy Paul helps create one of the first national Indigenous organizations. It's actually a precursor to the Assembly of First Nations. One of the ways that he does this is he goes from Indigenous community to Indigenous community, relying on his lacrosse context to start this organization. One of the first, I think the first community to sign on to this new North American Indian Brotherhood, it was called, was Ganawage. He was staying with the people that he had been playing lacrosse with and recruiting, and it started this precursor to the AFN. Well, despite losing the series in 1936, the North Shore Indians were and remain more than a lacrosse team. They were a pride of a nation, a chance for Indigenous peoples, especially the Squamish, to stand on an equal footing with their non-native counterparts. Nowhere else in Canadian society could Indigenous people stand on an equal footing. They weren't allowed to drink, they couldn't work in most industries or go to movie theaters or hire lawyers. But here, in the national spotlight, an all-Indigenous team became a voice for not only the Squamish, but Indigenous peoples across the country. Thank you very much for your time, and I hope you enjoyed this presentation.